does that word mean? Why don't you hear it on this radio station? Can you use it in Scrabble? Do you want some answers? If so, don't touch your radio dial, even if your radio doesn't have one. Our guest in this edition of Radio Curious is Stephen R. Kleinedler, the supervising editor of the fifth edition of the American Heritage English Language Dictionary. Curious, as I sometimes am, I wanted to know where all the words came from in the 2,084 pages of the American Heritage Dictionary. So when Steve Kleinedler and I visited by phone from his home near Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, on November 16, 2012, we began when I asked him to explain the origin of word lists that we now call dictionaries.
About many centuries ago, and over the course of time, people started codifying lists into the earliest were more glossaries, if you will, a list of words used in various settings, whether they were business terms, terms for trade, that kind of thing. I think in modern day, the purpose of dictionaries, in at least the United States. For example, in France and many European countries, there is an academy associated with the government that that proclaims, what is in France, what is French, what is not French. The Académie Française has a very strong say in what is considered a French word. Here in the United States, of course, there is no one authority. There's no government body that states what is a English word or not. But instead of that, there are a number of publishing companies that have popped up over the past couple centuries even. And I think one of the things they helped do in the early days was regularize spellings. And as spelling was taught more and more in school and people picked up on what the correct spelling of a word is, the importance of dictionaries carried through for, exactly what you expect, defining what words mean. It became a resource that people knew was being curated by a group of people who were trained to concoct definitions, to draft definitions, write definitions, so that it could be used as an educational tool, as a tool of confirmation, or simply as a way of learning more about the language around you.
So let's bring that to new words and new usages and how they are determined. Crazy ass, yes. For instance. That's a crazy ass job, a crazy ass movie.
That's a good example of a slang term. I don't think we actually enter that into the American Heritage Dictionary. I will check that right now. But it is definitely a slang word. We're not really known for, we're not considered a slang dictionary. There's absolutely nothing wrong with slang, but that's not the focus of what we do. And that, of course, would be a combination of crazy and ass. And, that's one of the great things about the English language is you can create new terms by putting together other terms.
At some point, words are entered into the dictionary through the usage panel in the American Heritage Dictionary. How does the usage panel determine what is acceptable?
Well, that's not exactly what the usage panel does. When it comes to adding new words into the dictionary, that is up to the staff, the editors on staff. What the usage panel does, and I should explain that the usage panel is a group of about 150 scholars, language professors, linguists, journalists, authors, people whose careers involve language. What we do is every year the editors send them a survey of a couple dozen questions asking for their opinion on various usage issues. In almost all cases, these involve words that already exist and may have there may be some dispute as to whether or not a word or phrase is proper. A good example of that is the word irregardless. Is it a word? Is it not a word? Is it acceptable? Is it not acceptable? That's the type of thing that we put forth to the usage panel, and we'd ask them to judge its acceptability. And then after the definition, we'll have a little note explaining what the usage panel said about such words. So it's a great panel. There are a lot of really wonderful people on it. This year, for example, we just added the crossword puzzle maker Will Shorts. So we get their opinions on how various terms are used.
Well, let's use irregardless as an example. What does it mean?
Well, irregardless, as it is used, basically means regardless. It is considered to be a non-standard term because years of of grammar school teachers and language critics have said it is not. I mean, it's considered to be non-standard. And most language critics agree that it is non-standard. What's interesting about it, though, is that the reasons why people think it is an illegitimate word is because it's redundant. You've got the negative prefix ear and the negativity of the less subject, the suffix less, so that it's like it's redundant or a non-word. What's interesting, though, even though people, professors and copy editors would insist that a writer use the word regardless instead, the reasons why people dislike irregardless, the redundancy, there are many examples in English of words that could be considered redundant and aren't. For example, the word debone means the exact same thing as bone. The word unravel means the exact same thing as ravel. So this is an instance where a word is considered to be non-standard simply because a lot of people think that it is, and that's what we report.
So who makes the decision about it going into the dictionary?
Ultimately, the decision to enter a word is that of the editorial staff. Something like irregardless is put in because it is a word people are definitely going to be coming across. It's widespread. People use it. So we're duty-bound to put it in, but again, we put it in, we mark it non-standard, and we give a usage note explaining why we've given it this label.
So in your role as the supervising editor of the American Heritage Dictionary, what level of control do you have in determining what word goes in?
I have the same level of control as the rest of our staff. There is no one person that has the authority or the ability to enter a word without other editors weighing in on it. And as it turns out, in the process of creating the fifth edition, the staff was pretty much in agreement with most of the words. It's when you've been doing this for a while, it's relatively straightforward as to what should go in and what not. But when we propose new words, we share the lists with the other editors. People can weigh in on whether they think something should or should not go in. And I should add, sometimes there's very little discussion because a very good example of that would be chemical elements. When scientists synthesize new chemical elements, and when the experiment that they've done to synthesize it has been replicated, and it's decided that it's a legitimate element, there is a group of scientists, of chemists and physicists, who decide what new elements are going to be called. And once they issue their decision, that's a word. That's for last year, they element 114 and 116 were added, fluorovium and livermorium, to be exact. And once they sent out the press release saying that this, in fact, is the names of these elements, they become as standard as gold or uranium or radium or any other element, and then they go. However, that's not always, it's usually not that easy, and there's usually You have to look at other factors, how widespread a term is, who's using it, is it used across the country, what context is it going to be used in, and we use all those criteria as a basis as to whether or not to enter a word.
Once a word is in the American Heritage Dictionary, it remains, or at some point do words drop off?
It usually stays in. We enter far more words than we take out. Part of the reason is that we don't put a word in unless we think it's going to stay around for a while. And this goes back to the slang issue we were asking about earlier. We're not really likely to enter a term just because it's being used in the news for the past 2 weeks and it's a really big word and we think we want to make sure a word has staying power, that it's not ephemeral before it's put in. So they're more likely to be taken in. That said, occasionally you'll come across an obsolescent word, a term that's really fallen out of usage and isn't relevant anymore, or perhaps it was a slang term that was, entered back in the 70s. For example, about 5 or 10 years ago, I removed, for some reason, there were a couple slang terms for a couple of kinds of marijuana that must have been added back in the late 60s or late 70s, and there was really no reason why those would be in there and not others, and they were obscure, so that was a deletion that we could easily make.
What were those words?
I remember one of them. I believe one was the type of marijuana called Panama Red. Have you ever heard of that?
In the 60s, I heard of it, yes.
Okay. So, yeah, it was the rationale was it was odd to have one or two dated slang terms for types of pot when there are dozens of others of kinds of pot that aren't in, and that's the type of slang that changes year to year, decade to decade. So it was kind of out of place. Again, had this been a slang dictionary, absolutely, it would be a perfect example of a word that can go in. But since this isn't construed to be a slang dictionary, it didn't really fit. It was dated and obsolescent.
Well, I want to ask you about when the word pot entered the dictionary. But before we do that, I want to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Steve Kleinedler, who is the supervising editor of the new edition of the American Heritage Dictionary that is published in the fall of 2012. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Steve, when did the word pot, meaning marijuana, enter the dictionary?
The word was added, I'm honestly not sure if we had it in our first edition or not until our third edition. The other interesting thing about the word pot is the origin of it as a slang term for marijuana isn't actually known. But it's been in for quite a while, along with, I would imagine, grass and other very basic generic slang terms.
I can share with you and from my experience in living in San Francisco about 45 years ago that marijuana was grown indoors in a pot, and that's where the term came from. But I know only that.
That may be one theory. The thing about folk etymologies is they often turn out to be as right as they are wrong, or often there's something where people will... after the fact, come up with that etymological background. I can say that the exact origin has not been ascertained, and there are linguists who devote their entire career to studying. There's one linguist who has studied the history of the word jazz for decades now, and still hasn't come up with the exact origin. But a lot of earlier supposed origins have been disproven. Because this researcher has been able to find ever earlier and earlier instances of it. So, especially with slang terms, it's fairly hard to pinpoint the exact origin. Although that's a likely source, it hasn't been verified.
When you say the correct etymology of a word, what are the elements that go into determining what is correct and what is not correct?
Oh, I am looking, for example, at the other word pot right now, a container made of pottery or metal or glass or something. We know that this word pot comes from Middle English, where it was also spelled P-O-T. We know this because there is a Middle English dictionary that had been researchers at the University of Michigan collected every Middle English text that ever existed. Unlike modern English, where there are millions and millions of books, and thousands and thousands of books come out each year, they created a word list, and then from that they made the Middle English dictionary, which is 20 volumes long, contains every word that was ever written in Middle English. So we have that on record. And then in this case, they know that this comes from an Old English word, also pronounced pot, but spelled P-O-T-T. Because they have evidence from that. And from that, it is assumed, but can't be proven, that it came from a vulgar Latin form, potus, P-O-T-T-U-S. But you've got 200 years of philological study, discovering, back to the people who discovered the relationship between Greek and Latin and Sanskrit, and from that, projecting back another generation of languages to something called Proto-Indo-European. And by studying records, you can go back and determine how certain words came into being.
A little while ago, you mentioned that before a word is put into the dictionary, you want to determine if it will be around for a while. So again,
right,
what are the elements that go into that determination? How can you forecast the future use of any given word?
It becomes an educated guess. Having done this for a couple of decades, you kind of get a feel for what might be successful and what might not. A jocular instance of a word that is used in a newspaper column, especially if they're trying to be humorous, probably isn't going to go anywhere, and you can wait long enough to see whether or not that type of term gets picked up. Whereas certainly in the areas of technology or cuisine or the sciences, you can see that a word is being not only it is being used, but it's being used by other people. A good example of that, and a word that we just entered, you remember, you're familiar with something called barcodes, which are the little things on products that you buy. They can scan them, and they know how much the object costs. They're used for inventory control. Now there's something called a QR code, and that's, if you're looking at advertising, the little black and white grids that appear on, say, billboards or in magazine articles. And if you hold up your cell phone or your smartphone to that, you can get information about it. That thing is called a QR code. We put it in. They've been around for a couple of years. They are. You see them as often as you see barcodes. People discuss them in the media. You read newspaper articles about them. Not only that, it is a concrete name, QR code, for a concrete object. So that's more likely to stick around than some slang term that is a synonym for drunk or beautiful or crazy or something.
Steve Kleinedler, let's talk about how grammar changes.
Okay.
Phrases like, where are you at, as opposed to, where are you? Are those acknowledged in the dictionary?
More acknowledged in a style book, and we do put out a comprehensive guide to usage and style, because you're not really talking about the definitions of the words there. Whether you say where are you or where are you at, where still means where, are means are, you means you, at means at. So often the type of response we will give is, depending on the circumstance, if you're speaking very formally, for example, or you're writing an essay, or you may want to avoid such phrases because some people regard that as sloppy speech. If that's not of a concern, I speak much differently hanging out with my friends, for example, than I would if I were giving a speech. So what we try to do is give people the framework into which they would feel most comfortable using a particular locution.
There are certain words that we can't say here on the radio. For example, the slang for feces or the slang for sexual intercourse. Do you have any comments on why they're in the dictionary, but we can't say them on the air?
Well, they're in the dictionary because they're words. Why we can't say them on the air, that's an issue for the FCC. To be perfectly frank, you can't say them on the air because if you do, the FCC is going to fine you. But at the dictionary, we just put them in because they, in fact, are words. Now, we don't put them in all of our titles. In our big one, they're there, but certainly in our smaller titles, our juvenile titles, we don't include offensive terms.
How about snafu? Is that in the dictionary?
Yes, absolutely. And it's in there with the etymology that drops the F-bomb. Within the dictionary, we use words as words. And, you know, the F in snafu comes from the word that we can't say on the air, and that's where we show it coming from.
So what is the etymology of that word?
It is from an acronym, Situation Normal All F'd Up, with F'd, of course, being the word that we can't say on the air.
What is accepted language? Accepted language is, I presume, in the American Heritage Dictionary and many other dictionaries, but it's not accepted enough to be spoken to the anonymous public forum of radio and television.
Again, that's the doings of the FCC and sociological mores. We can point out, which we do, you know, at the entry for the F word, we point out that it's vulgar slang, and we show the reader through whether something's informal or slang or vulgar or offensive. Then it's up to the reader. The user of the dictionary, like, well, am I in a situation in which vulgar slang is appropriate? If not, then I probably shouldn't use this word. So, again, we're just reporting how language is being used. So why the FCC frowns on saying those seven words that George Carlin pointed out, that would be a question for you to ask the president of the FCC.
Let's talk about Scrabble.
Okay.
Our conversation now seems to present a set of rules or a set of guidelines for a word that can be put in the dictionary. But how about words that should be or could be, and I guess that's the operative question, acceptable for Scrabble playing?
Well, Scrabble, trademark owner of Scrabble, licenses word lists from one of our competitors, Merriam-Webster. So I can only speculate as to how they go about doing it. We don't write the Scrabble dictionary. One of our competitors does.
So with the growth of the internet, how do you see the future use of a dictionary as compared to an internet hookup to use a dictionary?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't think any of us can forecast what's going to happen electronically in the future. I mean, certainly for now, our dictionary is available in print and will continue to be. Our dictionary is available online at ahdictionary.com and will continue to be. And it's also available as an app. So as technological changes occur, we will look at each such technological change and determine whether or not it's something that can be done in that medium.
Well, Steve Kleinedler, supervising editor of the new edition of the American Heritage Dictionary, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask some questions about you.
Awesome.
Could you tell us about an aha or eureka moment that has changed your life?
Oh, boy. I think probably, and tying directly to this, I had dropped out of school and moved to Chicago, after a year off, I realized, I should get my bachelor's degree, and I was accepted into Northwestern, and I essentially had I had to choose my major right away because I transferred in as a junior, And I wasn't sure what to do. And it was definitely, I don't know if it's the same aha type of moment as Archimedes' aha moment, but it came to me, linguistics. This is something I should do. It certainly changed my life.
What would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
Well, I have the luxury of being someone who really enjoys their job. I would very much hope that I can continue to do this until I retire. And retirement is quite a ways off, so I'm only in my mid-40s, so I haven't really thought about what I want to do when I retire. But until then, I hope I'm able to continue doing what I'm doing now.
Earlier, we spoke about Scrabble. Are there other word games that you could tell us about?
I play Words with Friends on the iPhone. There's something I think called Bananagrams, where you've got upside-down letters that you turn over and make words really fast. That's really fun. Pretty much Scrabble and Words with Friends are the two that come to mind.
And finally, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
I am a big fan of the cyberpunk genre. I really love the works of William Gibson and Neal Stephenson. And in a tie-in, if any of your listeners are really into language play, codes, there is an enormous book by Neal Stephenson called Cryptonomicon, which it's set in a bunch of different eras of history. One of the eras is during World War II, about the code breaking between the British and the Germans. It's a fantastic novel, and it's I should reread it soon. It's been a little bit since I've read it.
Well, Steve Kleinedler, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Stephen R. Kleinedler is the supervising editor of the 5th edition of the American Heritage English Language Dictionary. The book that he recommends is Cryptonomicon by Neal Stephenson. This interview was recorded on November 16th, 2012. Over 400 Radio Curious programs may be found on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free as my gift to you. I hope you enjoy them. Our address is 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541, and email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnestad is our assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.